Okay, so we'll have all our speakers back up to the podium, please. So thank you very much for a very interesting and scary talk, I think, given everything that you guys have been through, but glad to see the recovery is going so well. Were there any questions that came up on the cards? I didn't receive any cards, if anybody had submitted cards. Okay. Anybody want to start off with a question from the audience? Right, so I will start with some questions. So first question really goes back to Dr. Van Holder and kind of switching gears back to thinking about uremia and the whole concept of the Holy Grail, is often been called. Can you just maybe make a comment in terms of what your impression is of uremia? I think it's safe to say that the Holy Grail of trying to identify the one uremic toxin has long since gone. It's really a plethora of multiple different solutes with... What are your thoughts on that kind of concept?
Yeah, I think each group has its own specificities, but even if you look within a group, the characteristics may not be the same. For instance, in many of the studies that have been done with xenobiotics, they are comparing what's happening to indoxyl sulfate and paracrysyl sulfate, but they do not go in parallel. And we also have now just finished a study that is published in Gut, and where you can see that the vector, the way bacteria are producing indoxyl sulfate and paracrysyl sulfate is totally different. There are different species that are doing that. So it's not really very simple. And, of course, for dialysis, you could say all these molecules are more or less going in parallel. So I have been thinking a lot about this recently. Should we replace KT over V urea, for instance, by something that is based on beta-2 microglobulin and indoxyl sulfate? That's an option. But I think, on the other hand, my personal feeling would be try to remove as much as you can. Nobody ever has shown that you could remove too much. Do the best of dialysis in the best way you can do, according to evidence-based medicine, rather than fixing on parameters or markers.
Can I just ask you a follow-up question to that? So when you think about the progression of chronic kidney disease to end-stage kidney disease and versus acute kidney injury... If you think about the progression of chronic kidney disease over a long period of time to end-stage renal disease versus the more acute rise in, let's call it, azotemic toxins in acute kidney injury, the rate of accumulation... at least appears to be anecdotally important in terms of patient symptoms. So do you think the converse is the same when you talk about removal of as much toxins as possible with the best dialysis? Do you think that the rate that happens is of importance to the patients as well? So going back to the earlier conversation, that longer, slower dialysis is going to be better than shorter, more intense dialysis? Is that...
I'm absolutely sure that long dialysis is removing more and better. It's depending on the type of toxin. Middle molecules, you even do not have to provide much flow. Just time is enough. For protein bound, it's much more difficult. There if you keep your flow the same and your surface area the same, then if you're prolonging dialysis, you do better. But if you would reduce flow, together with prolonging dialysis, not too much is happening. But time is certainly good also for other reasons, also for hemodynamic stability and so on. And that's, of course, a bit the kind of paradox that both physicians, as a matter of fact, and even more in the United States than in Europe, and also the patients, they are wanting short dialysis, so that's paradoxical. So something is wrong with our way of educating patients. And that's also why I feel that home dialysis, if it is possible, is offering much more flexibility in schedules than in hospital or in center.
Okay. So one question from the audience kind of relates back to the slides that you showed about urea and toxicity are not of urea. And this question is creatinine toxic?
There are virtually no data, no. I mean, there are no data showing that creatinine is doing something. But creatinine belongs to the group of guanidines, and there are many other guanidines that are really exerting toxicity. ADMA is also one of the guanidines. But the curious thing is that the kinetics of guanidines are completely different from urea, although molecular weight, protein binding, they are all the same, also origin. And so it's something completely different.
Okay. Are there any genetic defects that you're aware of that cause isolated increases in blood urea concentrations?
Genetic?
Yeah. Any genetic defects that cause...
I think, yeah, there are so many genetic factors. Everything that's generation probably is different. Metabolism is different. Racial effects are playing a role, but we don't know very much about this. I also think that the systems react in a different way, that somebody will react more heavily to a certain toxin than other people. We also see huge differences in protein-bound uremic toxins. If urea increases by a factor of 5, between the patient with the lowest value and the highest, then for indoxyl sulfate is a factor of 100. So there are all sorts of elements that are playing a role we don't know.
Okay. Another question related to your discussion. Are there any specifically neurotoxic solutes?
Neurotoxic. Guanidines. I think also everything that's pro-inflammatory is neurotoxic. I think the guanidines are actually the main ones that have been studied. Also, paracrysyl sulfates of some of the protein bounds are also doing so. But you always have to be careful about in these toxicity studies, but because some of these toxins have been much more studied than other ones. And it's not, if they are studied more, you find more. So that makes it also a little bit more complex. But surely there are.
Okay. Other questions from the audience?
Thank you both for your really amazing presentations. One of the reasons why the program committee wanted, suggested that the two of you should be actually in the same session is given Dr. Van Holder's extensive experience with renal care following disasters. And I was just wondering, what are the main differences between the experience you had, Ray, and Mabel, comparing the various disaster situations the two of you have been experiencing?
I think there are many parallelisms. Of course, the big difference for you compared to what we had is not related specifically to the disaster, but to the fact that it's an island, and a small island. Actually, that's one of the most dramatic things that I realized when I listened to your talk. We always could escape. It took us 100 kilometers to drive a patient or to fly a patient or to use the sea. But actually, we always have had the principle, of course, it's earthquakes. It's also something different from a hurricane. But we always had the principle that we should get out with our care of the damaged area. The only place where we gave care in the damaged area was Haiti, that also was an island. And that also did not go very well. So that, of course, was one of your major problems. The good thing, if I may say, about the hurricane is that you can plan. In an earthquake, you never know what happens to you. And it happens afterwards. It comes back all the time. A hurricane is once. Now, this was an extremely fierce one. That was also one of the problems. But, of course, one of your relatively positive things is that, as far as I understand, you are part of the United States, or you are more or less part of the United States, so you have some...
Well, probably. Well, I think that one of the interesting things with, and the difference is, when you have a hurricane like our case, instead of earthquakes, with earthquake and the type of response that you get, you know, interestingly, in Puerto Rico, United States, it's United States sent this boat with a, which is a floating hospital, and it was sitting in Puerto Rico. Nobody was going there at all, because it's different from an earthquake with, when most emergency were people with fractures and they require surgery. The problem with the hurricane in Puerto Rico, and that's why we didn't know anything about really a real death toll for months, because the mortality that we saw in Puerto Rico were people who have chronic illnesses. And people were sick before the hurricane, and then they were not able to get their chronic medications. Patients with diabetes, the diabetes got uncontrolled. People with end-stage disease couldn't get to dialysis. Patients with chronic illnesses, they couldn't get the care that they needed. So most of the mortality that we saw in Puerto Rico were people that were already ill, which is, we didn't see much acute renal failure. We didn't see any acute kidney injury in Puerto Rico in pediatric population. We did have 74 cases of leptospirosis associated with this, and all of them were adults, so some of them developed AKI, but it wasn't really AKI. When we were dealing there, specifically our patient were patients with pre-existing renal conditions that they couldn't get care, and their health got deteriorated and got complications from there.
Of course, in earthquakes, you also have the problem of chronic patients, but it comes a little bit later than the acute patients. And we were not, the first time I went to Turkey, I was not well prepared. Actually, we had to improvise everything. Mm-hmm. And it took us about 1 week to realize that there was also a problem of chronic dialysis patients. Mm-hmm. Then later, when we had Hurricane Katrina, I warned the American colleagues that there would be a mm-hmm. problem with chronic patients, but they also had time to have the machine running. Mm-hmm. One of the advantages we have had is that we worked under Médecins Sans Frontières, so that we were under a large NGO that was used to offer rescue and help. And so things went quite organized. I liked very much your remark about volunteers. I think that's a problem sometimes with disasters, that they show up with goodwill, but they don't know what to do, and they are more doing harm sometimes. Mm-hmm. They want to eat, they want to drink, they want to go to bed. So, and that was a good thing about Médecins Sans Frontières. They have this kind of schedule how to work with it. But I think their circumstances, to a certain extent, with an earthquake, are better, quote unquote, than what happened to you, because you were completely isolated. So I admire very much what you did.
So another question from the audience related to the hurricane experience. The mayor of San Jose was very outspoken. Did she exaggerate or understate the situation?
The mayor of San Juan is a very dynamic woman. She's a politician too. So, but I think most of the things that she was saying were true. So when she was saying people are dying, people in Puerto Rico were like, she's a politician. And then when finally we had a final death toll about 3,000 people, she was right, you know. And I think one of the problems with Puerto Rico, the people that were in Puerto Rico, because we have no communications at all, we really didn't know what happened. The extent, like, my daughter was in Miami, and she called us, and she was in tears because she was watching the TV, and she was seeing the disaster, but we didn't have access to that, like, until a month or 2 months after the hurricane. So we didn't realize what happened, but, like, myself, I live, like, 9 meters from the medical center. I couldn't go to the hospital for 2 days because the streets to get out of my community, which is in San Juan, close to the medical center, were completely blocked by fallen trees. So I couldn't get out. We didn't have access to any TV. So it wasn't until we started going out to the community to help that we realized the extent of the magnitude of the hurricane. So when the mayor was saying people are dying, and people were like, she's exaggerating, then realized that we have 3,000 dead. Well, she was probably right. People were dying at that time because they needed medications. They needed to get access, you know, to the chronic medication, and we were not doing anything with it.
Was there any thought, or maybe the actual supply issue was still the problem, for acute peritoneal dialysis as a kind of a temporizing measure if you couldn't get the electricity or you didn't have the generators for
Yeah, actually, you know, with the communication problems, We were, in our pediatric population, we were able to get all our patients back in the hospital in our unit getting dialysis in 48 hours. So we were able to provide that. None of our patients missed a single treatment. However, with the peritoneal dialysis patient, it took us between almost 14 days to reach out all our patients because we couldn't reach them through phone or anything. And we were very nervous with them, but at least we said, well, they have supplies. They know how to do manual exchanges. They receive peritonitis, but at least we know they can do dialysis at home. That's what they were doing. They were instructed some of them had generators, but after 2 days, they didn't have fuel for the generators. But at least they were able to do manual exchanges. So acute peritoneal dialysis or chronic manual changes is great. Actually, we use acute peritoneal dialysis in Puerto Rico in our cardiovascular intensive unit all the time for the patient with acute kidney injury. So. Okay.
Did you have a lot of problems with burnout of your personnel?
Yes, but the problem with this is, again, you know, we have one of the nurses that was staying in the hospital. When he went back, he didn't have a house. So some of the nurses that were in the hospital, they didn't realize that they lost everything. So when they went out, they realized they didn't have a house. They didn't know anything about their family. So it was very difficult because the volunteers and the personnel, they're going through the same disaster of the rest of the community. They didn't have food. No, actually, we started getting a lot of supplies and food. And one of the things that we were doing is, you know, the first night, I was giving them, you know, take this home. And one of them told me the next day, doctor, thank you for giving me the package that you gave me with the salad. Because when I went home, I didn't have anything. So that's what I had for dinner that night. So it's difficult because people are coming and they are great. They're very, you know, they have this altruistic feeling and they want to help. Because we're talking about people that they are leaving their homes, they are leaving their families and have problems. Myself, you know, I left home and my wife was basically taking care of everything that happened in our home because I wasn't able to stay there. Mm-hmm. And she's a doctor too, but she's in an administrative position, so she was able to stay home and take care of everything. But most of everybody was impacted with this, and especially the personnel, you know, it was very difficult for them to keep coming to work because they had a lot of friends also. So we had burnout.
Okay. It's nearing time for a break. Any final questions from the floor? There's one question just down here at the back.
Hi, I live in Eastern North Carolina, and we have had a lot of hurricanes recently. One of the things that we had trouble with was actually having our patients turned away from some of the shelters because they were too sick. Did you have any of that experience, or did you have trouble with your patients actually having a safe place to be outside of your treatments?
Well, actually, it's interesting. If you look, we have some patients that had to move to shelters, like we have a couple of patients with neurogenic bladders, chronic conditions, and the sanitizing conditions in the shelters were not necessarily the best. So it wasn't the best place to be, but for some of them was the only place really to be because they didn't have a house. We didn't have any problem with hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis patients that had to move to shelters. And the other thing that was interesting, though, we were discharging patients from the hospital because they were fine. They could go home, but they didn't have a home to go. Or they didn't have electricity. So patients were coming to the hospital, or they didn't want to leave because they have water and electricity in the hospital. So why going back home when they have no electricity? So we have to improvise a ward just to keep patients there, and they were basically living there because they didn't have a place to go even when they were medically fine. So some of the two dialysis patients that we kept in the hospital, we kept them in the hospital because we didn't want them to go to shelters. Patients on peritoneal dialysis, it would be very difficult to do peritoneal dialysis in a shelter because it's overcrowded, you know, a lot of people there. So we kept some of those patients in the hospital, and we had a couple of patients that didn't have a place to go, and we asked them to come to the hospital, and they were living in the hospital for a month.
Okay, thank you both very much for very entertaining discussions this afternoon, and thank you to the audience for all your questions. We'll close this session. We'll come back at 4:05, so 4:05 for the late evening session. Okay.